Hi. Have you joined me over at Patreon yet? That's where the images to accompany the episodes are, and those are free to everyone. If you do join, you get early access to episodes and special bonuses. You also get the satisfaction of knowing that you are helping to keep this podcast going. If you are presently listening to this through Patreon, or if you're one of my PayPal supporters, well then thank you for your encouragement. Now on to today's show. Hello, and welcome to World of Warbirds. I'm Brian Pierce. Hello, Warbirders. So this episode is part of a series. So if you're just discovering this podcast, firstly, welcome aboard. Secondly, step out to take in the F4F Wildcat, the F6F Hellcat. And if you're a Patreon member, you have the opportunity to hear about the F5F Skyrocket. So go get caught up on what you missed, and we'll be right here waiting for you. So, now that I've encouraged people to get caught up on the earlier cats, the OCD listeners out there might be upset that we've gone and jumped over a number again. This time, the F7F. I didn't forget it. There's a reason for skipping it, and we will get back to it, I promise. Introduction. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll recognize a trend when I'm speaking about the development of a particular aircraft or a series of aircraft. Usually at some point I will say that the type or the new aircraft was up-engined by a new, more powerful motor, or that the engine itself was modified to deliver more horsepower by installing a new supercharger or turbo supercharger or water injection system. But, what do you do when the engine you have is pretty much the pinnacle of the technology and you're not going to be getting the deus ex machina of a more powerful engine to save you in getting more performance from a new aircraft? Well, I suppose you could just settle with the performance you presently have, but then again, what would be the point in that? Why build the new aircraft at all? This was the dilemma that Grumman designers found themselves in during late 1942 and 1943. The engine that they had wasn't going to change much. Now, it was a pretty damn good engine. The Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp was the same beast that powered such notables as the single-engined Republic P-47 Thunderbolt and Vought F4U Corsair, and multis such as the Douglas A-26 Invader and Martin B-26 Marauder, amongst many, many others. It was a two-row, 18-cylinder, air-cooled radial which cranked out a reliable 2,000 horsepower. It also was the power plant that had given their Hellcat such great performance and allowed it to become the zero-killer and ace-maker of the Pacific, as well as seriously pulling its weight over in Europe with the fleet air arm of the Royal Navy. But Grumman was still obsessed with climb performance, and with good reason. At the start of the war, when U.S. pilots were struggling to hold their own against the Japanese Zeros and their sisters, with Grumman Wildcats and Brewster Buffaloes, Grumman officials had heard again and again from pilots that they needed to get upstairs faster. So like a dog with a bone, or I guess a cat with a mouse, Grumman had obsessed on the matter. They also had another serious problem that needed solving. The escort aircraft carrier was a pure World War II invention that had gone from nothing to let's build as many of these things as we possibly can overnight. The Allies ended building up an astonishing 130 of them. World War II production of all kinds never ceases to amaze me. So what's the problem? An escort carrier is useless without airplanes to use on it, and the F4F Wildcat, although it would soldier on throughout the war to the very end, was becoming obsolete. So you say, big deal. Grumman is cranking out Hellcats like toasters. so assign some of them to the escort carriers. Well, they couldn't. The Hellcats were too big. Everybody always goes on and on about the P-47 being so big and a juggernaut and all that, but the Hellcat was just as big. In fact, it even had a bigger wing area, and so it just couldn't operate on the baby flat tops or Jeep carriers, as they were called. So, do you see where this is going? We need to get more performance, but without a bigger engine. We also simultaneously need an aircraft that can operate on a smaller ship. Looks like we're headed for Smallville. Small is beautiful. Nice things come in small packages. Less is gonna be more. Design and development. Grumman's team, working under Chief Engineer William Schwendler, one of the founders of the company, went to work. There were similarities to the Hellcat in what they came up with. The new fighter was also a cantilever, low-wing monoplane of all-metal construction. And it used the same NACA 230 airfoil that carried the Hellcat. But there weren't going to be too many similarities. How could there be? Schwendler was aiming for a fully loaded weight of 8,750 pounds. The Hellcat weighed 9,238 pounds empty. Let those numbers sink in. With a pilot, full fuel, and weapons, the new fighter was going to be about 500 pounds lighter than a Hellcat without any of those on board. Keep that in mind as we talk about some of the radical things that they did to keep the weight down. Firstly, it was going to be small. 5 feet shorter than the Hellcat. In fact, it was 6 inches shorter than the Wildcat. Yes, you heard that right. The wingspan was even shorter than the Wildcat by 3 feet. The small sizes meant that on a crowded flight deck, 50 of the new fighters would be able to fit in the same real estate taken up by 36 Hellcats. Less is more indeed. Getting back to the wings, of course, they still had to fold because this was a carrier fighter. But the new fighter wouldn't get the trademark Grumman stow wings. It would get a much more simple and lighter hinge system that would fold upwards manually by the ground crew. While we're speaking of wings, we need to talk about the other radical design decisions made for this wing. And when I say radical, I mean it. The feature that I'm about to describe, I have never heard of being installed on any other aircraft before or after. As always, if I'm wrong, I'd love to hear about it. So if anyone knows about this being installed on any other aircraft, let me know. So, in order to withstand G-forces, the wing has to be made strong. Well, duh, right? Well, to make the whole wing strong enough to withstand high G-forces requires a lot of weight in order to beef up the wing structure. Now, stick with me here. Some of that heavy structure way out on the wing is only going to need to support high G-forces very rarely. So the rest of the time, the plane is hauling around that extra structural weight for nothing. The Grumman team pondered, what if we just left it out? Of course, the answer to that is that in some of those rare, very high G maneuvers, it could break. Okay, well, airplanes have come back without wingtips before. What if we made the wingtips intentionally weak, and thus lighter, and provide a breakaway point where they would snap off in a controlled and expected spot that would still provide enough lift to get back to the carrier? On the ship, they would have a supply of the expendable wingtips, which the deck crew could just reattach. But what happens if one tip breaks off and not the other, causing a radical imbalance? Easy. Provide explosive bolts to blow off the wingtip that is hanging on. Yes, that was the plan. Part of the wing was designed to break, and if it didn't break, it would be intentionally blown off. The radical diet didn't end there. Another constant theme in this podcast is adding more and more and bigger guns. Not here. The new fighter was getting only 4 50 caliber machine guns. It was also only going to have a 160-gallon internal fuel capacity, while the Hellcat had 250 gallons. Remember, they have the same engine, so the new fighter was going to have both limited firepower and limited range. Even the tailhook was made more simple and lighter. Once it was extended, the tailhook could not be retracted from the cockpit. Flight deck crew would have to manually push it back up. Even the prop was smaller. The Hellcat had a 13-foot, three-bladed Hamilton Standard propeller. A slight reduction in size was made by moving to a 12-foot Aero Products four-bladed propeller. There are times when the weight saving seems obsessive and even silly, reminding me of the stories of Lindbergh cutting the margins off his maps to save weight. I don't know how many pounds they saved by leaving out a seat adjustment mechanism, but they did. I guess cushions are lighter, and that is what the pilot would have to use to adjust his seat. Some items just couldn't be compromised. There would still be ample armor protection for the pilot, engine, and oil cooler, no matter the weight penalty. To still maintain adequate strength for punishing carrier operations, a thicker aluminum skin would be used. But there are four factors in flight: thrust, drag, weight, and lift. We haven't spoken of drag reduction. Dedicated care was taken in reducing drag around the engine cowling, leading edge intakes, and the rivets were all flush. The canopy was a super slippery bubble style with great visibility for the pilots. Alright, so that was the theory and the goals. It was time to start building prototypes and see if the theory would translate into flying and fighting reality. Prototypes. The blueprints were completed by November 1943, and that same month orders were placed for two prototypes of what Bu Air called XF8F1, and soon would be known as a Bearcat. So what is a Bearcat anyway? The animal is also called a binturong and lives in Southeast Asia. It is neither a bear nor a cat and looks somewhat like a sleek raccoon, but without the distinctive markings. Enough for the wildlife lesson, let's get back to the airplane. The first prototype flew only 9 months later in August 1944. Some results were great. The Bearcat's rate of climb was 30% higher than the Hellcat, with 4,800 feet per minute and an impressive top speed of 424 miles per hour. Compared to its established sisters, the Hellcat and the Corsair, the Bearcat was more maneuverable and, as I just stated, climbed much better. But there were criticisms, including complaints about a cramped cockpit, poor directional stability, an erratic airspeed indicator, and the landing gear operation airspeed needed to be increased. Oh yes, and the pilots also asked, Oliver Twist style, "Please, sir, could we have more guns?" I don't know if anything was done about the cramped cockpit. It seems that the Bearcat was so small you couldn't even say that you put it on, like some fighters. Instead, you saddled it up. A fillet, just forward of the vertical stabilizer, fixed the directional stability problem. Oh yeah, the extra gun request was turned down. But it was time to start building Bearcats. Production. The test pilots in the Navy were impressed enough with the Bearcat to sign contracts only 2 months later. Grumman was to build about 2,000, and General Motors would build about 2,000 more. The GM birds would have a slightly different engine and a small increase in fuel capacity. Bearcats began flying out of the Grumman factory in May 1945, the same month the war in Europe ended. In August, the war against Japan ended too, and so orders were slashed. GM's contract was completely cancelled, and Grumman's was trimmed down to 770 machines. Which is still a pretty good order, considering there's no more war to fight right now. In 1948, the F8F2 was introduced. The cowling was tweaked, and it had a slightly more powerful engine, turning out 2,240 horsepower. There was a taller vertical fin, probably to counter the increased torque of the more powerful engine. Later models had the 50 calibers replaced by 20mm cannon. A dozen Bearcats were built as F8F2N night fighters, and 60 F8F2Ps were introduced as reconnaissance fighters. Grumman continued building them until 1949. Operational history. So unlike most other aircraft I've profiled, this one never fought for its producing country, although it was extensively used. It took over primary duties from the Hellcats and equipped 24 fighter squadrons with the Navy and Marines. One thing that didn't quite work as was hoped was the snap-off wingtips. It was one of those things that worked well in controlled conditions, which isn't the real world and definitely isn't carrier aviation. There were several accidents where one wingtip broke off and the other didn't at low altitude and the aircraft crashed, killing the pilots. Another time, a ground technician died when the explosive bolts blew up unexpectedly on the ground. In the end, the snap-off wingtip experiment was ended, the tips were strengthened, and the aircraft had a G limit of 7.5 that the whole wing, including the tips, could handle. In 1946, Bearcats took over duties with the Blue Angels, replacing the Hellcat, and they flew it until 1950 and the start of the Korean War. Speaking of Korea, did you wonder why Bearcats didn't fight there? At the start of the conflict in Korea, there was little air opposition, and so a pure fighter wasn't really needed. What was needed was ground support, and the F-4U Corsair was judged to be better suited for that job. But the Bearcat did see combat, but just not with the United States. In 1951, France ordered 200 Bearcats for its Armée de l'Air. Why would France want these nearly obsolete aircraft? Cost. They got them for a really good price, and they only intended to use them in French colonies, especially Indochina, which, you know, was heating up. Just like Korea, the need was for ground attack, which, as I said before, wasn't really the Bearcat's thing. But the price was nice, and because of its carrier-based pedigree, it was great for use on short, even grass airstrips, some of which had been built by the Japanese during their war. Although it wasn't ideal for ground attack, it was fast, so when a call would come for help, it would be there quickly. And soon, HVAR rockets, 1,000-pound bombs, and napalm would be on target. When the French War in Vietnam ended in 1954, the French forces left behind 28 Bearcats. They served with the Republic of Vietnam Air Force until 1964. Survivors. The Bearcat, known as Rare Bear, is a rare bear indeed. In fact, she probably shouldn't exist at all. The Bearcat with the construction number 122629 was enrolled in the Navy in 1948 and flew with several active squadrons until 1952. That year, this Bearcat was bumped to a Naval Reserve Unit and then to a Naval Air Reserve Training Unit in Alabama. Between 1953 and 1956, it bounced around in storage at various naval bases until 1957, when it was struck from the U.S. Navy with 667 hours of total time. Between 1957 and 1962, her history is fuzzy, but on the 21st of August 1962, Richard Finnell was hired to ferry the Bearcat, now registered as November 1031 Bravo, from Georgia to her new owner in Wisconsin. During a fuel stop landing at Porter County Airport in Valparaiso, Indiana, the Bearcat stalled, about 5 feet above the west end of the airport's runway and dropped hard onto the surface. The speeding Bearcat stayed on the runway for approximately 200 feet, then lurched alongside it for 1,500, then spun around violently, cartwheeled wingtip to wingtip, and ended up upside down. Finnell was okay, although it took a team of shovelers to dig a hole deep enough to get him out of the cockpit. He may have been fine, but the Bearcat was junk. Later, it was flipped over on its wheels and towed to a nearby property. There it sat for 6 years. During that time, it lost its R2800 engine and mount and prop. The outer wingtips had been chopped off for some reason. The horizontal and vertical stabilizers had already been damaged during its so-called landing. Its main service during that time, beyond being a bank of spare parts, was to be a plaything for kids pretending to be naval aviators. Then, in 1968, Lyle Thomas Shelton showed up. He was born in Brownsville, Texas, on June 15, 1933, later became a U.S. Naval aviator and then an airline pilot for Trans World Airlines, TWA. He was looking for a plane to work on, perhaps to do aerobatics, or maybe race. He took a couple of weeks off work, bought the wreck for $2,500, and traveled to complete the disassembly that had already been started by the crash and the parts cannibals. The bits and pieces of airplane were loaded onto trailers and trucked to Compton Airport in southern Los Angeles County, California. There, Shelton and a team set to work. They installed a Wright R3350 duplex cyclone engine. This was not the type of engine that the Bearcat was made for. The 3350 powered such monsters as the Douglas A1 Sky Raider, which was 10,000 pounds heavier than the little Bearcat. This engine turned a propeller and a spinner taken from a DC-7. Because the nose was so bloody heavy, 300 pounds of lead was installed in the tail to get it within CG limits. The plane was dubbed Abelcat and placed fifth in the 1969 championship race. That's pretty good, from going to wreck to racer in under a year. But over the years, this Bearcat would continue to suffer its share of misfortunes and maydays. During a race in 1970, the big 3350 engine developed trouble when too much nitromethane was added to the plane's water injection anti-detonation system. The engine was only running at 2 to 3 second intervals and smoking badly. During the forced landing, Shelton landed really fast and blew two tires and ground looped the Bearcat to save it and himself. In 1976, during another race, an oil line ruptured and the big engine seized up. Shelton set to land on the Mojave Airport's runway, but the gear wouldn't come down. He pitched the nose up rapidly to try to knock the mains down, but it didn't work. The Bearcat, which was now known as the Spirit of 77, ground down the runway on the tailwheel, the half-open gear doors, and two of the 13-foot prop blades. The Bearcat slid on a sheet of burning oil, but it stopped, the fire was put out, and the rebuilding began again. Eventually, the Bearcat was rechristened Rare Bear. More fixing and tinkering to the engine and supercharger allowed the 18-cylinder radial to pump out 4,000 horsepower. Adding in spurts of nitrous oxide pushed that up another 500 for an incredible 4,500 total horsepower. With all of that power and the flying skill of pilot Shelton, Rare Bear has won 16 racing championships and holds the world records for the 3-kilometer piston world speed record of 528.33 miles per hour set on August 21st, 1989. It also holds the piston time to climb record to 3,000 meters, that's 10,000 feet, in 91.9 seconds, set in 1972. The previous record had been set in 1946, also in a Bearcat. As far as I know, Rare Bear hasn't raced since 2015. But it has seemed way more down and out many times before. So, who knows what the future brings for this rarest of Bearcats? As for other surviving Bearcats, they are well represented in both static and airworthy conditions. Turns out that with the Bearcat, less definitely turned out to be more. In our next Grum and Cat episode, we will be going a completely different direction with the F7F Tiger Cat. We're headed for more is more country, or maybe even more is maybe too much territory. Until next time.